A conversation with Paula Poundstone. Well before she became a regular presence on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone was a prominent force in the world of stand-up comedy. Since the 1980s, she's specialized in live audience interaction. These days, however, in the midst of a global pandemic, that's difficult. But like other determined performers, Poundstone turned to the internet to maintain some connection with her audience. And she returned to the road. She has three live shows in Maine coming up and has just released a new album of live stand-up called Paula Poundstone Goes to College for One Night. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll talk with Paula Poundstone about her career in comedy, inventing new ways of performing, and finding humor in the mundane. Maine Calling is just ahead. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Did you hear the one about the stand-up comedian who tried to ply her craft in the midst of a global pandemic? It wasn't funny. But if anyone can get a laugh out of what we're going through now, it's my guest this hour, Paula Poundstone. In 2020, Time magazine declared her HBO special Cats, Cops, and Stuff one of the five funniest of all time. That's of all time, mind you. And we're joined by Paula Poundstone right now. Paula, welcome to the program. It's great to talk with you today.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to be with you.
And if you would like to join the conversation, the number, 1-800-399-3566, that's 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk at mainpublic.org or tweet at MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. So you've got three shows coming up in Maine this week. What's it like to be back on a stage interacting with human beings?
It's fantastic. I do feel like, of course, I mean, we're still in the midst of what we're in the midst of. I asked people to be vaccinated, fully vaccinated and masked. Because for two reasons. One is that I really love people and I don't want them to get sick and die. But second, and it's way far away, like if it was a running race, the first reason comes in much before the second reason. But the second reason is it's just not a good business model to kill your fans.
Yeah, you need them.
So I feel strongly about that. But, you know, once we're there, we're all in there doing our thing. It's so nice to be able to laugh about what we've been through, what we're going through. It's, you know, a sense of humor is part of what nature has given us as a coping mechanism. And so it's a night of coping.
Take us back to that glorious spring of 2020 when things were shutting down and you were starting to realize, hey, I've lost my means of making a living.
Yeah, it struck me gradually. I don't know that I had ever even heard the word pandemic in my life. I'm not a historian. I didn't know about the Spanish flu. I don't know. So I had no experience of anything like this, obviously. So yeah, my jobs. I was on my way to Aspen one morning to tell my little jokes. And they made me fly in a day early because it's not always easy to get to Aspen. On my way there, my manager calls and tells me that my next night's job has canceled. And then before I can get to the airport, she calls and tells me that my next night's job has canceled or postponed because of this virus. And I still went to Aspen because they hadn't made up their mind. They didn't decide till the following day. And the following day, by noon, they said, okay, we're not going to do a show. So I fly home and I'm thinking, right, a couple weeks maybe. And it was sad and difficult, but I thought, well, you know, I'll just tighten my belt. And then I had to tighten my belt for a really long time. After a while, it dawned on me. And what's funny is, you know, my manager would call me and say, because that was March. And she would call me and say, well, you know, the date's been moved till May, And I started thinking after a while, like, okay, you know what? It's not going to happen in May either. And when I would say, I think it's going to be at least through the summer, everybody would go, you're so negative. You're so negative. And of course, it was 15 months.
So when did you realize, or was there a point where you said, okay, if I'm going to nurture my audience and keep this relationship with these people that have followed me and loved me, and because you do kind of have to, it is a relationship. When did you decide, oh, I've got to take some steps to reach out to them or make some sort of connection with them?
Well, when I thought it was going to be, you know, weeks or, you know, couple of months at the most, my immediate reaction was to make comedy videos. I started making these videos with a character named Miss Nancy, who was doing online, you know, what do they call it? Distance learning for her first grade class. And my daughter was here at home with me. My kids are all young adults now, but my middle daughter was here at home with me, and she would help me. And we were banging out, like, I also did a couple of Joan of Arc talking to people about, you know, about being brave and about what Joan of Arc had been through, and that if she could do it, we could do it. And so I did those like a couple a week in the beginning for weeks, just thinking I was keeping people's spirits up. That was my sole goal. And I would read people's comments, and it seemed like that's what was occurring. And it felt really great. And then, I don't know, it dawned on me that I had no income. I think my accountant called and he said, you know, you have no income. And yeah, that's when things got kind of real. And so I put up a thing online saying, you know, gee, you know, it kills me to do this, but if you enjoy a video, could you just send me $1, right? And it didn't really stem the tide of loss. But what I was able to, oh, the other thing I did was I started making a little homemade game show that I did once a week. I did it for a year. And it was fun. It was on Zoom. I hate Zoom, but it was on Zoom. And one of the things that was great about it was we posted it so people could watch it. But the people that joined in on that night that were on the Zoom show, it became a group of regulars. And it was fun and comforting to check in with people and see how everybody was doing and tell everybody how I was doing.
But it's not sort of your thing, right? You have this historically, one of your things is to interact with the audience, to interview them, to find out about them, sort of get to know them in front of everybody else, and then extract this this funny stuff that most of us can't see or don't notice so quickly or don't put together so quickly. That's kind of your superpower, right?
Yeah, and you're right. Well, the thing about the goofy game show, and it really was goofy, but the thing about the goofy game show, like we decided who went first by I would take my computer outside and throw a tennis ball in the air. And I'd ask one of the contestants, you know, do they think my dog Mo will catch the ball without a bounce? And if they were correct, then they would go first, that sort of thing. But the thing about the goofy game show was that I could, via Zoom, interact with individuals a little bit. It was a far cry from the real thing. The other thing that happened in the very beginning, because, you know, I think a lot of people thought that performers in general probably were just sitting around. I worked my butt off. Although I would reach my hands back, and there it was. But I worked very hard. Because the other thing that happened, and this was the day I came home from Aspen, the phone started ringing and emails started to pile up of every charity I'd ever done, and many theaters that I work all asking. The charity organizations that do a big fundraiser once a year, that's really their bread and butter. And we're talking about really worthwhile, important charities. I'm trying to think, the Valley Health Clinic, things like that. And they all reached out to me and said, can you make a video or can you do our Zoom show? And they would say, well, we're going to do our gala virtually. And they would all say it like that was good news. And many of these people believed that I could do stand-up comedy from my living room. And I kept saying, yeah, it's really not like that. It really doesn't work that way. And they would say stuff like, well, we have such and such a musician and they're going to do it from their living room. And I'd go, yeah, it's different being a musician. I'll tell you something. I came to be so bitter towards musicians. In fact, all right. So the NewsHour, which is my favorite televised news broadcast, the NewsHour on PBS, which I watch religiously, they did a story about Mary Chapin Carpenter doing intimate concerts from her living room. And they even aired it twice. And, here's Mary Chapin Carpenter with her guitar singing, and the people at the NewsHour were oohing and aahing. Isn't that wonderful? Look, it's so intimate. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, and her dog came in. Isn't that great? And everybody apparently loved this. But again, I couldn't do the same thing. I came to hate Mary Chapin Carpenter. I became aggressive towards her. Honestly, I didn't even know her. But I started saying this publicly. I was kidding. I started saying that I hated Mary Chapin Carpenter and that I was really angry with her because these musicians, specifically her, were able to do this thing that I couldn't do. And so when I did finally start back out on the road, I was working a theater in Virginia one night, and I go into the dressing room and there's some flowers there. Well, sometimes theaters give me flowers. Yeah. And there was a little card. I didn't open it up right away because I thought it was from the theater. And, you know, I kind of knew what it was going to say. And then I thought, well, I should open it just in case they say something to me about it. So I open it up and a piece of paper falls out from a card. And I open the paper and it's a printout of an interview that I did, wherein I said that I hated Mary Chapin Carpenter for this reason. And I go to read, and then I look at the card and it says something to the effect of, Paula, we love you anyways, Mary Chapin Carpenter. And I went out on stage and I told the audience the story about these flowers. I said, oh, it's got to be a joke. It can't be from her. And somebody in the audience goes, no, she's a friend of mine. She asked me to send the flowers.
Well, hopefully things are good between you guys now.
We've patched things up.
You've moved along.
But I do still feel this, you know, the thing about stand-up is that you cannot do it from your living room. So when I finally got back onto stage, you're right. It was, there were things that I could do. I could do a character. I could do, I could do an interview. There were ways of presenting myself. And I did for every one of those charities. But it's not that relationship with the audience. And I know that every therapist listening will think this is like the sickest thing they've heard, but the audience is my best friend. And when I'm not with them, I miss them.
I want to play an excerpt from your new album, out, Paula Poundstone Goes to College for One Night. Now, was this recorded at or near Harvard?
It was recorded at Harvard. You know what? It is the audio of a HBO special.
HBO special. Okay. Well,
and this is about years. Like, was that? You know, could they get that somewhere? Where could they hear that? Blah 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 blah. So we finally put it out as an album. Well,
this is an example of you interacting with an audience member, one of your best friends, who you really don't know, and we'll play that now.
This woman on the end with the Harvard sweatshirt. What are you studying here?
Psychology.
Psychology? And did you have class today?
I'm not in psychology.
You're not in psychology? Is that what you said?
No, it wasn't a psychology-related class.
It doesn't have to be a psychology-related class, ma'am. Was that the question? What the hell's the matter with you people? How did you get in this school? You must have had incredible recommendations, because the things you could fill out yourself are limited. Now, what class did you have today?
I had a midterm in Myth of America.
Myths of America? Is America in your answer anywhere, ma'am? It was a Myths of America class and you had a midterm?
Mm-hmm.
What myths are there in America?
You really want me to answer?
Is that what you answered on the exam?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the audio. I'm not even sure if it played, but and it was an example of you interacting with a person at Harvard, and it's sort of it goes on. It explains later on. You get a cell phone from the audience, a member, and call her roommate, and there's an exchange there, and it gets funnier and funnier. But I guess I'm wondering. Some comedians like to get out on stage and, have their material all pre-written, get out there and, test it over multiple times, make sure that it's working. You like to go out and kind of without a safety net and just sort of use people and, if you will, and kind of draw them out and find out bits about them and turn that into something funny. Is that something that you sort of realized early on that you could do well?
Yeah, but it was because I started in Boston in 1979. A, I had no idea what I was doing. That was part of it. But B, in the beginning, you know, when you would do an open mic night, the premise being that anybody who wants to go up can go up for 5 minutes. That's sort of the way those were run. And you would have people on the list to go up that had never been on stage before. And you would have some people that were much more accomplished. But you're given this 5 minutes. And everybody was it was such a, you know, a burgeoning activity at that time, that there was quite a long list of people who wanted to go on stage. And so if you went over your 5 minutes, people got really mad. I notoriously went over my 5 minutes, because what would happen is I would memorize my 5 minutes. I used to bus tables for a living, and I'd be bussing tables. If you looked carefully, you could see that my lips were moving, because I was practicing while I was bussing tables. I was trying to memorize this 5 minutes. And then I would get to stage and I would panic and forget what I meant to say. And then I was forced to just sort of say whatever, to sort of work the room and figure out what I was doing. And therefore, I didn't know where I was on the clock any longer. And then, you know, you usually try to end with something strong so that you can do that, you know, thank you, good night thing. as opposed to just sort of petering out, which is more my style. But so then I would be stuck trying to find something I could get off stage with. And this would keep me on stage longer. and the longer I was on, the more I knew everyone was going to be mad at me. And so I would just sort of hide on stage, basically. But anyways, this caused me to, sort of reach out to the audience and just look for stuff that I could do something with. And my originally, because everyone was so mad at me, originally I felt like, oh my gosh, this is terrible that I do this. You know, this is a big mistake. And then one day it dawned on me that the stuff that I managed to get from talking to the audience was often much better than anything that I had written. And so I started sort of straddling both worlds, leaving myself enough playroom that I could do something else, but also having some material that I could go to if I had to get off stage without the other comics sticking out knives.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this fascinating conversation with Paula Poundstone. We invite you to your questions and comments as well. Email talk@mainpublic.org. Post a comment to Twitter or Facebook page or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactical experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Learn more at bullmoose.com. And Dean Sweets, offering Maine-made chocolates for corporate and personal gifts throughout the holidays and throughout the year. DeanSweets.com. And Northern Light Health, healthcare that's Maine-found, Maine-focused, and Maine-proud. Learn more at MaineMadeUs.com.
Big work stoppages are usually pretty well documented, but smaller strikes often go unnoticed. So what does one see upon closer examination?
A lot of workers are really frustrated after working on the front lines of a global pandemic for over a year and a half, and they're striking and protesting because of that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What labor has been doing this pandemic? Next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace today at 6:30.
For business owners across Maine, Maine Public's audience is your audience.
I'm Ellen Tracy. We're here at Eastern Mold Remediation in Eastern Basements. We're a family-owned and operated business. We started with Maine Public 5 years ago. Maine Public has been the most successful aspect of our marketing efforts. I just can't say enough good things about our experience.
Visit us at mainpublic.org to get started.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our guest today is comedian Paula Poundstone. She has a new album out. It's hard to say the word album. I haven't used it in a while. But it's titled Paula Poundstone Goes to College for One Night. And she has a few appearances coming up in Maine in the next few days. Check our website or her website for details. And we invite your comments and questions for Paula. Email talk@mainpublic.org. Comment to our Facebook page or on Twitter or Instagram. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You know, Paula, there's this, you know, there's the old cliche, I guess, you know, about at the risk of being a armchair comedian psychologist here, that you know, comedians kind of became funny because they were compensating for something as a kid, you know, that they didn't have. They were overweight or unpopular or and so I guess, were you compensating for something as a child? Or
I desperately wanted to believe that I was. It's such a silly idea in retrospect. But when I was in high school, I was so into the Tears of a Clown thing. And I'm embarrassed to tell you that I maintained that idea well into adulthood. I don't know on what day the cold fish of reality slapped me in the face. But one day it dawned on me, you know, it's the luckiest job in the world. And no, people, you know, no. Everyone grows up with some type of unhappiness somewhere. It's just, it's an emotion that's on the, you know, on the scale of emotions. And we, you know, somewhere in my head, though, I really did believe for the longest time that I was on, you know, I was on some sort of an emotional journey. I mean, I think that people that are, you know, people that grew up as minors, maybe they're compensating for some form of, you know, or people who, you know, work in factories, maybe they're compensating. But no, comics, really? It's a pretty charmed life.
Right. Let's go to, let's bring in a call.
Difference is that we talk about it. Right.
Yeah.
We'll tell a story about growing up. Whereas, you know, minors don't necessarily share those things.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Let's bring in Blaine, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Blaine. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks a lot. I just want to say hi to Paula Poundstone, and you are one of my favorite comedians for years, Paula. I have watched you, listened to you, seen you on various platforms. Recently, I saw you with your friend Stephanie Miller, which was really, really fun. And I had a question for you. I myself have dabbled in improv in my little small town of Bangor, actually have hosted some improv jams in the past. And then in the past 3 years, I have gotten into acting in community theater here, having a blast with that. And I kind of want to venture into some stand-up at some open mic nights around here in the near future. And the question that I have for you, with improv, you have like I'll call it the crutch or the help of somebody else with you on stage. In theater, you have the script that you know, hopefully, when you land on stage for opening and for the run. And then, of course, you have your other players on stage. But man, in stand-up, I'm not nervous being on stage now that I've done this, these different, you know, on-stage theater performances. But in stand-up, it's sort of like what is your, like, safety? Or, like, with you, of course, it's like years of experience and you know where you're at. But, like, for newbies that want to get into that, any advice on that in terms of, you talked about preparing stuff, and you're more of an improv. And I was wondering if improv might be a good route for me in terms of playing with that when I do it. I guess that's my question.
Got ya. You know what? You're going to have a blast. Yeah, the thing that allows me to really comfortably go in an unscripted way about what I'm doing is that I solidly have in my head pieces of material that I can go to if I feel like, whoo, boy, that's not happening. Or if I just, you know, when I talk to an audience member, you know, 9 times out of 10, we have a conversation that is unique just to that night. But there's also that 10th time where they say something that reminds me of a piece of material. And so I say that. So, you know, you kind of go with, it's like you've packed your overnight bag. You know what I mean? And it gives you, or you got your survival kit in the car. And so you go with some confidence.
You've got flares and a blanket and you're right. Yeah,
exactly. And then you can go other places, always knowing that you can go back to that. You're going to have a great time.
See, you
do just a few minutes. Don't go on for 20 minutes. Don't go on for 30 minutes because you're not going to have 20 or 30 minutes, that you can confidently turn to.
Paula, when you step out onto a stage at Harvard or anywhere else, are you nervous about how it might go at all? Or are you excited about how much fun it's going to be?
Anytime there's any kind of recording, I'm nervous. Even like in the beginning of some of the early shows that I've done during the pandemic, they've done that thing, what do they call it? Streaming. And I feel awkward with that even. But I don't know, if it's just me in the audience and I know that it's just us, I don't generally feel nervous. I generally do feel just what you said, which is excited to get to talk to them. I try to have myself sort of mentally in a place where I'm brimming with things that I would like to tell them. Like when we used to visit my grandparents, as we drove to Alabama or West Virginia, you know, I would always be so excited to get out of the car and tell them something. And I try to sort of have that feeling,
Do you think if you weren't doing stand-up, would you be the same in public? Would you just kind of get up and talk to strangers and ask them what they do for a living and have fun with it? Would that give you something?
I don't think I would do it in public, but because there was a learning curve to all that, of course, a really, what's the word, typical sort of stage fright and all that in the very beginning. But I've always been the kind of person who, if I meet somebody, I like to talk to strangers. And if I meet somebody, you know, a cashier at a store, or, you know, or a clerk helping me in a store, or you get the idea, you know, that I've always enjoyed talking to people. In fact, I really worry about our society, even prior to the pandemic, you know, assuming that we can turn so many things over to technology, like, for example, self-checkout. I feel like it's an enormous mistake, because those little conversations that you have with people that you do not know, you may be familiar with their face, but you don't know them. The person who works in the grocery store, you know, where you just go, oh, my gosh, I like your hair like that. Or, geez, it's cold out. Those little teeny connections are part of our emotional nutrients. And when you lose those, when you take those away, maybe you don't notice it the way you would notice, you know, not being in contact with a friend, but it's a loss.
Let's go to Liz, who's calling from Lovell. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi, Paula. We're big fans of you. And my daughter, who is now 15, loves to hear you on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And
I have to
agree with you about that, the self-checkout line. I refuse to go there because I like to interact with the people in the checkout line. But here's my question for you, and I'm trying to figure out how best to phrase it. I work in healthcare, and it's certainly been a little challenging recently. And I've been trying to find the moments of lightheartedness. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what have been the most powerful moments of comedy or humor with relationship to COVID and this past X number of months that we've been going through?
Well, I did for a solid year with, you know, one or two weeks exceptions. I guess that makes it not a solid year. I did for a year volunteer at a friend of mine started a food bank, and that experience was so much fun, real physical labor. I mean, hard work in that way. But we did it once a week, and you know, you felt like you were doing something. It was just fun to be with these people that were all, you know, working in the same direction. And then I considered it my personal goal to connect with everybody who, because people would come through in their cars once the boxes of food were prepared, to pick up the food. My boss was forever yelling at me for slowing the cars going through because I was talking to the people picking up their box of food. So that was easily the best, you know, antidote to, you know, we had lots of laughs. Yeah.
All right, Liz, thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more
thank
of your
you,
questions and comments. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Lender Foundation in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, who are bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum, and MIMIC, with the mission to improve workforce safety and injury management, and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy. And Evergreen Home Performance, a locally owned energy efficiency company with career opportunities available. Details at evergreenyourhome.com.
I'm Robin Young. New York's Tenement Museum is now exploring the intersection between Black history and immigration with the stories of two Joseph Moores, one Black, one white.
They are in the same city at the same time, with the same name, with the same job. So we have to compare, because part of what we have to understand is how that played out.
Next time, Here and Now.
Join us for Here and Now today at noon. Whether you're in your car or in your kitchen this Thursday, let Maine Public Classical be the soundtrack to your Thanksgiving. Join hosts Sarah Tuttle and Aaron Ingebrith on Thursday from 11 to 2 for classical music designed to help you celebrate with family and friends and keep you calm in the kitchen. Sarah and Aaron will share holiday recipes and heartwarming stories, a Thanksgiving special not to be missed this Thursday from 11 to 2 on Maine Public Classical.
You're listening to Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Joining us today is Paula Poundstone. She was the first woman to perform stand-up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Her list of other firsts is too long to mention. She has a new album out, Paula Poundstone Goes to College for One Night. The last caller, Paula, mentioned, of course, everyone knows you for this, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I'm wondering when you first were invited to do that show, what you thought of it, because I was always wondering what the pitch meeting was like for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You know, when they said, well, the idea is we're going to put some comedians at a table and then they're going to riff on tragic worldwide events, and then we'll have someone call in and win a voicemail message, and we'll put it on public radio. But I guess, you know, the real question there is, like, were you at all concerned about, gee, you know, news is very serious and a lot of it is bad stuff or tragic stuff or difficult stuff, and how were you going to turn that into yucks?
Oh, you're a lot more analytical about it than I ever would have been. It never even occurred to me what you're talking about. You know, they called me. I had never heard of the show at the time. I wasn't on the original panel, but I was. I think I was there maybe by the second or third year, probably. So, and this tells you how long ago it was. I think it was like, I think it was like 22 years ago or something. They sent me an audio cassette of the show, and in the house that I lived in at the time, we had, you know, that big thing in the middle of a kitchen, what do they call it, an island?
Island, yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I bought that house, my real estate agent, I said, is there any way we can get this thing out of the kitchen? And she said, oh, no, that's your island. You're going to love your island. And boy, she was right. We vacationed there every summer for years. But my concern about the island was that junk would pile up on it. And I was absolutely correct. So one day I was standing in the kitchen with this guy that was a nanny for my kids, and he saw the this tape from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he said, oh, I love that show. And I said, oh, really? Like, I hadn't listened to it yet. And he goes, oh, you have to do that show. So that's really why I did it. I didn't know too much about it at the time. And by the way, way back then, we did not have an audience in front of us, and the show had never experienced having an audience in front of them. We didn't travel. We all were, Peter was in, there's a cat playing with a cat toy behind me really loudly. Peter was in Chicago. Carl Castle was in Washington, D.C. Adam Felber was in New York City. I was in Los Angeles. And we all went to the NPR station nearest us, and we were hooked up via wire. It was in the middle of the day, or it's not even the middle of the day, the morning, and we recorded the show. Then somewhere along the way, they were asked, I think this is how it happened, that they were asked by a local public radio station somewhere in the country to come do a show on stage of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And that's, I believe that once they tasted that elixir of life, there was no going back for them.
Now, do you prep for that? In other words, do you anticipate, these topics are likely to come up in the news, and therefore, you know, here's my potentially hysterical joke about that? Or is it all on your feet?
No, you're right. We all know that the questions are going to be about the week's news, and there's nothing I don't know about the others. I can't tell you if they do or not. I never have thought of jokes ahead of time. I do prep in that I pay particular attention to the news that week, because I'm prepping so that I can win the quiz show, not so that I can be funny. It's very important to me to win the quiz show. And now that I've said this, I'm so glad to have this opportunity to clear up a misconception about my participation on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Yes, I'm trying to win. A lot of people think I throw the match intentionally. I'm just not very good. But it's not because I'm highly competitive. I'm just not very good. The others I feel cheat. They were born into the world knowing more about, you know,
that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that
word? Current events. They were born into the world knowing more about current events than me. It's cheating. That's what it is. It's cheating.
Let's go to Ava in York. Hi, Ava. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'll just jump on that last comment by Paula because, ironically, if you do get the questions wrong, Paula, the comedy part of your answer is actually worth more. I mean, I'm happy when you win, but if you don't, it's just hysterical. And so we tune in whenever you're on. So that's a fun segue. My comment is just about comedy and laughter in general. I've always thought it is kind of the great equalizer. I grew up in the 60s. My dad used to play comedy albums of all the former greats every Sunday, and we knew them back and forth. And when I was in high school, although my teachers didn't think my humor and people laughing, they didn't take kindly to it. But when we graduated high school, and I would tell you, we had an alumni, and we all got together and said, who can we get? And Jay Leno graduated from our high school, so we got him. And in 1978, hysterical stuff. I mean, it was wonderful. And so I think comedy does that, especially in these more difficult times that, you know, we've all gone through. But also I did want to say that what I do and have done for 37 years, I'm a career coach. So I just want to say congratulations, because to have a sustainable career is difficult at best in entertainment, and comedy is even more. But for pursuing your passion, because that's about as good as it gets, to enjoy what you do every day, but then you also make people laugh, and that's really good. So, yeah, I wanted to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I'm very lucky to get to do my job. And a lot of it, honestly, it was just, some of it's the luck of the draw. A lot of it was just the timing. You know, I got in 1979, and I think it was easier to get started than it is today. Because I don't know that I'm really like a go-getter. Maybe I am. I mean, I was pretty adventurous when I was 19, but a lot of it is just plain luck.
Let's bring the cats in if we could here, but before time runs out, we'll go to.
They're being so obnoxious, I can't even tell you.
Just heard them. They appear to want some attention. Ken is calling from Portland. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Paula. Ginger and I just love your program, or love you on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but we want to check in for the cats, because I know it's been important that we make it through all of this. And I think the cats have been, at least our cat has been one of our saviors through it. So I wanted to do a check in with the cats.
I totally agree. Even as we speak, I just right then was spraying one of my cats with a water pistol because she keeps jumping up and hanging off the peace sign in the window. I can't remember. In June, I think it was, I got two kittens. I had eight cats, and my middle daughter kept saying to me, Mom, it's like we don't have any. And so I got two kittens. And I'll tell you, it was one of the smartest things I ever did. It really cheered me up so much. I mean, I love all my cats, but it was fun to have kitten energy back in the house again. You know, a cat to whom it makes sense to hang off the peace sign in the window. And I have two big dogs. Several months before the pandemic hit, I had gotten one of my dogs as a puppy. So one of the things we did, by the way, during that 15 months was we trained every night. I trained the dogs every night. And you know, dogs are such creatures of habit. It may have been a mistake in some ways, because now if I ask my dog, Mo, if I tell her to sit in the middle of the day, she looks at her watch. She says, no, we don't do that for another couple of hours. I think it's important to vary the time of day you train your dogs.
You grew up in Massachusetts, right? You weren't born there, but you grew up in Sudbury, Mass.
Yep.
And so I'm just curious, and I know you like Maine. Do you? I don't just like Maine.
I love Maine.
Do you have any sense of connection to New England? If you were to have to pick, where is your home? How do you?
Oh yeah, I'm a New Englander in the way that Ben Franklin was a printer. I've lived in California for far more years than I lived in New England, but it doesn't matter. I'm lucky. You know how you'll hear about somebody maybe that grew up in the army or something, their father or their mother was in the army, and they moved from place to place a lot. I mean, I'm very lucky that I lived, you know, my whole educational life, I lived in Sudbury, Massachusetts. One of the results of that is, I climbed trees, which, you know, you ask a kid nowadays if they ever climb a tree and read, and they look at you like you got two heads. And that was such a thing when I was growing up. We all climbed trees and read. You were supposed to. Do you know Helen Keller climbed trees and read? I'm not by herself, but Anne Sullivan used to take Helen Keller up in trees. It's very important to climb a tree.
Let's go to Essex, Massachusetts now and bring in Anne. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hello. I'm so glad. You've always been my favorite person on that program. And it made me think about my grandmother saying that good writing was the shortest distance between two points. You just directly go to it. And funniness is the same thing. You laugh before you understand why you're laughing, and then you can analyze it and think about it and realize and write down the reasons why afterwards. But my grandfather was the funniest person I ever met. And it was my ambition in life to ever be able to think of such funny things just instantly and to get the universal joke, which God is the author of, and everybody is sort of trying to get it, and some people do, and transcendentalists and funny people.
Oh, I don't think I've got the big one.
Emerson said that the earth laughs in flowers. But it's music is a universal language, and funniness is too. It brings people instantly together as humanity, and not, none of these little fights about anything.
Yeah. It is a great equalizer. I agree with you.
It just brings everybody to the point of love.
Yeah, Anne, thank you. Sorry, I think we lost you there.
Uh oh. Thanks, Anne.
Paula, any last thoughts, I guess, about, we opened with a caller saying, they were sort of a fledgling comedian.
Thank you, Blank.
When you look out on the horizon of as comedy, emerges, young comics, What are you seeing? Are you excited about what you see? Are there points where you kind of your points of concern? What's your take?
You know, I have no idea. I don't watch other comics. It would be a bit of a busman's holiday. And so I don't know any new comics. I work alone. I work theaters for the most part. I work about maybe 4 or 5 music clubs a year, but outside of that, it's all theaters. And I work alone, so I never see anybody else. And part of the reason I do it that way is just pure selfishness. I have the best audience in the world, and I simply refuse to share them with an opening act. I'm anxious to get out on stage to talk to them, and I have no desire to shorten the amount of time I get to be with them. And so I'm just a pig. In the world in general, I don't care what your job is, you better do it fast because I try to bring up topics very sort of intentionally on stage that I think that are important, that need focus. I don't know if Greta Thunberg would ever do comedy, but young people like her do give me a certain amount of hope. And when I back during the Black Lives Matter protests, one of the things that was really great.
We got to wrap up here real fast, but
one of the great things about those protests was that I was among young people of every stripe.
We're totally out of time. Thank you so much for being here. It was a really interesting hour. I appreciate it. Paula Poundstone can be heard weekly as the host of the comedy podcast Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone and as a regular panelist on NPR's comedy news quiz Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Her new album is Paula Poundstone Goes to College, One Night Only, and she's performing at Agunquit this Friday, Brownfield Saturday, and Rockland on Sunday. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.